That was putting it mildly. Come time to run from a battle, the slow and wounded die. That's just how it works. Ramirez just looked at Wild Bill and said with weary amusement, I'm Spanish, not Mexican, you damn Texan. Wild Bill put a hand on Ramirez's shoulder and flashed him a wolfish grin. River's shoulders came over and dropped to his haunches next to me. That put him on eye level with Chandler standing. The dapper Brit eyed the Sasquatch with a bland expression and did not flinch much.
How do you do? Rumbled River's shoulders.
Well, thank you, said Chandler, with the flawless, reflexive courtesy you only get from a finishing school. I understand you and Harry have worked together before.
Nah, River's shoulders said. He come and bailed me out a few times when I needed help.
He grinned. His teeth were very white. They stood out against the spatters of dark blood still on his fur.
But we did some good work tonight.
Chandler was too refined to take an intimidated step back, but he leaned. I had just retied one of my shoes when the order came back down the line from Ebenezer, who seemed to have de facto command of the group. Time to move ahead. I had just gotten moving again when there was a flash of violet light that streaked down the road, swept high over the group's line, and plunged down toward me.
My lord,
piped Major General Toot Toot. The little fay came to a wavering hover in the air before me and saluted, grinning fiercely at me.
There is knavery afoot.
Talk to me, Major General, I said, even as I broke into a jog to keep pace.
We didn't see them until they got there. The foe has sneakily snucked a sneak attack behind our lines, the sneaky sneak.
What kind of sneak attack?
The sneaky kind,
Toot Toot shouted.
They used veils and got around behind the lines, and now they're in the park, and they are up to something.
I frowned. What park?
Up ahead,
Toot Toot said.
On this road. You'll go right past it.
My already quivery stomach got cold. Toot, I said, thinking furiously and drawing out the word. That's not a park. That's Graceland Cemetery. And dimly, over the sound of all the footsteps in motion, I heard the thrumming thud of a large drum in the distance. My eyes widened. Hell's bells. I broke out of line and sprinted ahead until I reached the old man's side. Hey, I said, you hear that? Ebenezer glanced at me, frowning, but then turned his attention to the distance.
War drum?
No, I said grimly. That's coming from Chicago's most notorious graveyard. Toot says they slipped in under veils.
Necromancy, he spat. Stars and stones. How many zombies could they get out of it?
About 50 hectares worth of zombies, I said, a little exasperated.
A lot?
And they'd swarm Marcone's people in minutes. The old man snarled. Necromancy is a gift that keeps on giving. The same spell that animated corpses could be expanded to sweep up freshly made bodies as well. New corpses weren't as good for the work, but they'd be more than a match for the citizenry. It would mean death on a geometric progression. The old man scowled furiously for maybe half a minute. I let him think. It's important to think when things are going crazy, if you want to take the smartest action to get them sane again.
Okay, Hoss, he said heavily. We don't know how strong these practitioners are, but we know what's going to happen to our allies if we don't support them. So I'm taking the big guns ahead to relieve the pressure on the troops.
Got it, I said. He spoke in the slightly heavy tones of someone who was thinking through a problem as he speaks about it.
Practitioners means the council needs to counter them. You fought necromancers before. You've fought in that graveyard before. You're the best person here for the work.
He grimaced and spat.
Damn it. You got the job.
Okay, I said. Take the wardens and the Sasquatch. There was a huge fluttering sound, and I let out a little shriek and flinched, and it took me a second to sort out that an absolutely enormous, shaggy old raven had swooped down and landed firmly on my shoulder. I said.
Caw,
said the raven. Ebenezer scowled.
You're just damn useless in a military situation, he said to the raven. No discipline at all.
Redneck,
cried the raven.
Caw!
Ebenezer waved a grumpy hand at the raven.
Fine, take the Indian too. Silence that drum.
He put a hand on my arm and met my eyes.
Hoss, do not pull your punches tonight.
That's always been my biggest problem, I said, spreading my hands. All this restraint. I broke away from him and dropped back to the rear, where Ramirez was laboring along while the other wardens flanked him and kept worried expressions when he wasn't looking.
Okay, kids, I said. We got problems.
I explained the situation.
Yes, Wild Bill said. Necromancers.
I eyed him.
Seriously? I like shooting zombies, he drawled. That's all. I got a patch and everything.
Well, the idea is to stop them before they get the zombie horde rolling, I said.
Oh,
he said, disappointed.
That ain't half as much fun.
Damn it, Bill.
Yeah, he said. We'll get it done.
River, I said. The Sasquatch nodded.
Can't stand necromancers. Make the earth scream.
We gotta move fast, I nodded at Ramirez and winced. Sorry about this, man. Carlos looked from me to the Bigfoot. He was having enough trouble keeping up that he spoke in a gasp.
Damn it. Do it.
Give him a hand, I asked River. The Sasquatch promptly scooped Ramirez up. He could carry the man sitting on his palm under one arm with no more effort than a farm wife toting a basket of eggs. The raven on my shoulder squawked and took off into the night air.
All right, Toot, I said. Show me.
Graceland is, in many ways, Chicago's memory. The graves there mark the resting places of titans of industry, holy men, gangsters, politicians, near saints, and madmen and murderers. Tales of tragedy, of vast hubris, of bitter greed and steadfast love are represented in the markers that stand over the graves of thousands. Statuary, mausoleums, even a small replica of an ancient Greek temple stand in stately silence over the lush green grass. And yet, the walls around the cemetery are there for a reason. The shades of many of those folk walk the graveyard at night and are the source of thousands of whispered tales that make skin creep and flesh crawl. I'd been one of them once. I had a grave waiting for me in Graceland, kept open by force of whatever contract a deceased foe had prepared for me. There was no time to go around to the gates. We went over the wall of rough stone behind a large mausoleum and gathered in the sheltering darkness behind it. Toot descended to the ground, something I'd seen him do only occasionally, and the aura of light around him dimmed and went out.
This way, my lord,
Toot rasped in a low, dramatic tone.
They are near Ina's statue.
I grunted. The statue was a local legend. It went missing from time to time, and it came back just as mysteriously. There were often sightings of a little girl in Victorian dress skipping among the headstones when the statue was gone. And I knew it had once been used as a conduit by Queen Mab when her physical form had been busy keeping mine alive, just as the spirit of Demon Reach had inhabited a statue of death that dwelt not far away. Graceland is the repository of Chicago's greatest dreams and darkest nightmares. There is a power there, dark and potent, and I could feel it stirring and swirling in the air, like oil being heated over a fire and becoming steadily more liquid, quicker to move, to shape. The sound of the drum continued, a stalwart tempo. It would do a lot to mask the sounds of our approach, especially if we stepped in time to the beat. I dropped low and followed Toot into the darkness among the tombstones. I knew the place well enough to get around generally. Toot led me to a position a little uphill from Inez's spot, and I stepped on one headstone to belly crawl up onto a mausoleum and peer ahead. Spread in a circle near Inez's grave were seven cloaked figures. speaking in whispering voices in a breathy chant. One of them held a large drum on a shoulder strap and steadily struck it with a thick-headed drumstick in one hand. From there, I could sense the power of the circle around them, and they were making an effort to work magical forces without any sloppy inefficiencies of energy transfer, which generally manifested themselves as visible light. This was a stealthy working. There was a lump on the ground in the center of the circle. I couldn't see who it was, but it was human-shaped, if you allowed for some ropes for immobility. A human sacrifice, doubtless, for the ceremony's finale. It remained the single most effective way to turbocharge black magic. Hell's bells. 7 necromancers could wreck Chicago all by themselves. 4 of them nearly had done it once. 5, if you counted me, which I didn't, even though my entry in that evening's animation festival had taken best in show. I could feel the intensity of the working they had underway. I didn't know who they were, but they were pros. If they were allowed to finish, they could wreck the town without the help of an army of improbably conceived monsters. And if Toot and his people hadn't warned me, we never would have seen it coming. I wonder what it says about me that pizza has been one of the better long-term investments in my career. I slipped back down and away, unseen by the baddies. I returned to my allies and spoke in harsh, quick terms. 7. 6 casters and a drummer, cloaked, dark. I don't know who or what they are. They're with the Fomor, so they're probably bad guy leftovers from somewhere. They're in a circle. They've got a prisoner. River's shoulders growled. It was a sound so low that I couldn't hear it so much as feel it vibrating the bones of my skull. Where you want me? No time to get fancy, I said. Get behind them. You get 2 minutes. Then we'll go right at them from this side, make plenty of noise, and draw their fire. Once we have their attention, you get in, get their sacrifice out. Then I brought my hands together in a silent clap. Simple is good, River's shoulders said. Then he gave himself a little shake, bounded maybe 4 feet into the air off one massive foot, shimmered, and turned into a goddamned owl with a wingspan as long as a freaking car. The massive owl glided out over the tombstones, parking to one side, and vanished into the night.
Jesus, Remington Winchester Christ, Wild Bill blurted in a strangled voice. He's a wizard?
Yeah, I said. Todd Old listens to Wynn the way I hear it. Bill said. Now that just ain't fair. Don't complain, he's on our side.
I'll take 2, Wild Bill said.
I'd been counting in my head. When I got to 100, I said, okay, folks, just like the old days. Chandler, you know the drill.
I may have been in the field once or twice, Chandler said.
Groovy. The team of young wardens stacked up behind me, walking in close order, hands on shoulders in the dark to guide one another, and I headed out. Warden fire teams work very much like soldiers. Any one of us can put out enough firepower to kill every one of us if we're careless or stupid, and working together means developing trust and respect in one another's skills. I'd go first and make the call about when the fight started. If necessary, my shield would cover the entire team, who could then fan out, Hydra-like, and take out the source of any threat. Granted, if I stepped on a landmine or something on the way there, we were all dead together. But that wasn't how most supernatural types tended to think. I took long, striding steps in time with the drum, and as we approached the necromancer's position, I felt Ramirez's veil wrap us in a cloak of less than visibility. Yoshimo did something to the air that made us less than audible. They'd cover us until we got into place. Wild Bill whispered something to the lever-action rifle he carried instead of a staff these days, and plucked a rune-inscribed brass shell from his belt and slid it carefully into the rifle's loading port before closing the action with a cautious, precise movement. My leather coat creaked, and I sweltered in the summer's heat within its smothering protection. My shield was by far the noisiest and most obvious active spell we had among us, magically speaking, and it would be the last to go up. I waited until we rounded the corner of the last mausoleum, blocking our line of sight, to shake out the bracelet and ready my defenses. But first things first, we had two major problems to overcome. One, the bad guys were standing inside a ritual circle. We could throw as much power as we wanted at them. It would splash uselessly on that thing until someone took the circle down. So we'd have to do that before we could really come to grips with them. Second, if you want to control the dead, you've got to drop a bead on them. End that bead, end any possibility of summoning and controlling the undead. I drew my revolver with its boring old regular, entirely mundane rounds, stepped around the corner, and raised the pistol, sighting on the drummer. Swear to God, on a normal day, I barely shoot competently. But with the winter mantle guiding my hand, I lifted my arm and made a one-handed shot in the dark at maybe 20 yards that drilled the drummer in the back with a thunderous report. Two things happened immediately. First, the round passing through the plane of the circle, sent there by my hand and will, disrupted the essential magic screen of the ritual circle. Stealthy the working might have been, but nothing works right when it's falling to pieces, and it's shattered away in flickers and shards of scarlet light. Second, the round tore right through where the drummer's liver should have been. The hooded head whipped around, owl-like, nearly 180 degrees, with such unnatural speed that the hood was flung back. In the scarlet light of the disintegrating circle, I could see a ruined, desiccated face. The skin was drawn tight over the bones of the drummer's face, withered and weathered like a corpse exposed to the sky. The eyes were milky white, the lips were leathery strips of jerky, partly covering yellowed old teeth. Hair hung on to the scalp in clumps of soiled tangles, but much of it was bald and gray-white. A vampire of the Black Court, and I knew her.
Mavra of the Black Court, I snarled. You got a permit for raising zombies in my town?
Oh,
Mavra said. Her body turned to match the facing of her head, the motion weirdly liquid and mechanical at the same time.
It's you.
Five of the other six figures turned to face us, hoods coming down. Black Court vampires, all of them. I didn't recognize any of the others, but it seemed pretty clear that Mavra, as the drummer, was the least among them. The Black Court had been all but exterminated, thanks to a really underhanded move by Lara's people a century and change back. The only ones who were still alive, well, who continued to exist, were the oldest, wiliest, most vicious, and most powerful of their kind. These vampires were old school, the real deal, nightmares of the old world. A Black Court vampire was a match for any dozen counterparts in the Red or White Court. And we had seven of them.
My lord,
Mavra said,
may I suggest violence?
The last and tallest of the hooded figures straightened his shoulders, turned, and lowered his hood with one hand. In the other, he held a ritual athame, an ancient knife of rough iron. He stood over the bound figure on the ground. His face was not like those of the other vampires present. No rotted corpse he. His face had the severe, angular regularity of a marble statue's, beautiful in the severe fashion of frozen mountains and crackling ice. Thick, black hair swept back from his face and down his back. His hands were long and white, the fingers fine like an artist's, but his eyes dark, black, empty as the soul of hell. I had just looked toward them and they'd nearly sucked me in. Hell's bells. I shored up my mental defenses with as much focus as I dared spare from my environment and kept my eyes away from his face. So, he said. His voice was pure, smooth whiskey, touched with a soft, throaty accent. This is the city's wizard.
I'm in the phone book and everything, I said. In the name of the city of Chicago and by the authority of Cook County and the state of Illinois, I said loudly, hoping to give River that much more of a distraction, I order you to cease any and all supernatural activity and return forthwith to your place of origin or to the next convenient parallel dimension.
Ramirez choked.
Well, Wild Bill drawled, that ought to do it. Thanks, Harry.
Who is that? Breathed Yoshimo.
That, said Chandler in a low, shaking voice, is Dracul.
Okay. My eyes might have gotten a little wider. I might have had trouble swallowing.
Oh, boy, I breathed.
And Dracul smiled, as if genuinely delighted, and said,
wise enough to know, but not wise enough to run. Wizards, arrogant. Take them, my children.
Chapter 12. Elders of the Black Court do not screw around. Before Dracul had entirely finished his sentence, the air sizzled and spat with magical energy as five elders of the Black Court unleashed a tsunami of sorcery. I lifted my shield bracelet and stepped forward to meet it. Once upon a time, that gesture would have been futile. Defensive shields were a fairly standard working of magic, but they had limits. The more kinds of energy you want to defend against, the more layers of shielding it takes, and the more power you have to put into it. Back when, my shield had been handy for stopping objects that were moving very quickly, and not much more. But times had changed. I was older now. I'd learned lessons the hard way, and had the scars to prove it. So, five heavyweights hit me all at once. A couple of lances of white-hot energy, a sputtering globule of some kind of horrible-smelling acid, a crackling bolt of lightning, and what looked like a ghostly tentacle made of translucent green mist hit the shield like five separate speeding automobiles. My rough shield bracelet dripped green-gold sparks and grew uncomfortably hot in seconds. The shield itself flared out into a quarter dome of blue-white, nearly coherent light, a barrier of raw, stubborn will. Maybe if it had happened somewhere else, at a different time, I might not have been able to stop them all. Maybe if it had been just me, it would have gone badly. But tonight, my city was under siege. Tonight, millions of terrified people were going to die unless they got help from people like me. Tonight, their fear rode the air, an inflammable mist that needed only a magical spark to roar into reality. Tonight, Chicago fought for its life, and my shield held against them all. Though it scorched my wrist, though my feet were driven 6 inches back across the green grass, I stopped them. All of them. Meanwhile, my companions had not been standing around with their fingers up their anatomies. Yoshimo's arms swept out and whirled in circles, and within a second she sent a slender column of whirling air arching up over my shield and down among the Black Court. When the white column touched the earth, it roared into a whirling dervish of dirt and flying grass, blinding the foe and disrupting their evocations. Ramirez's hand came down on my shoulder, and he said, "Now!" I dropped the shield. Now, don't get me wrong. What the elders of the Black Court had dished out at us was enough energy to put us all on the ground and then some. But on the White Council, we call people with talent like that sorcerers. And we sneer when we say it for a reason. Yeah, maybe they can throw the raw magical strength around. But magic is about a hell of a lot more than simply power. And though they might have been young, the people backing me up were wizards of the White Council, and each and every one of them had cut their teeth on war. I checked over my shoulder to see Chandler standing calmly with both hands planted on the handle of his cane. A dozen stones the size of my head floated in a small cloud around his shoulders, and as my shield came down, the stones began to leap forward as if fired from a cannon, hissing toward their targets. Not to be outdone, Wild Bill murmured something to his old lever-action rifle, and the old steel of the weapon suddenly pulsed with threads of scarlet fire in the shape of some kind of primitive pictograms. As my shield dropped, he raised the rifle to his shoulder, sighted on the nearest vampire, and with a word sent a rod of semi-solid fire the thickness of my wrist right through the vampire's belly, and one of the huge headstones behind it alike, splitting the air with the thunder of sundered stone. The vampire let out a scream that ripped and slashed the air it passed through and was apparently pulled back and away from us by some unseen, horribly fast force. Ramirez cast a beam of pale light at the vampire whose strike had gone all hentai on us. That one was a large male, or what was left of one, and he swung both arms dramatically and sent his ghostly tentacle smashing into Ramirez's disintegration ray. The collision of forces was enough to turn the whole thing into a thrashing mess that spewed ectoplasm in every direction. Two of the vampires, who might have been twins or similarly sized siblings before all the decay had set in, blurred and became a pair of great, greasy, furred gray wolves the size of ponies. Both shot in opposite directions in great bounding leaps.
"Flankers!" I shouted. "Yoshimo! Bill!"
Yoshimo bounded a step into the air, and the wind itself seemed to gather beneath her feet and springboard her with silent grace to the top of the nearest mausoleum. She began to bound in 20-foot steps, her toes barely coming down to touch the top of grave markers, statues, and marble tombs, moving as if weightless to intercept one of the great wolves. Bill immediately swung away from his target, a move that took no small amount of discipline, to begin tracking the second wolf with his rifle as it swung wide around us, a flicker among the smoke and shadows. Bill was an old-school shooter. He welded his cheek to the stock of the weapon, sighting carefully, and went almost entirely still as the barrel tracked the enemy and Wild Bill waited for his shot. I was keeping my eyes on Dracul. The pale figure watched the fight with keen interest, eyes like a pair of black holes, drawing in everything and giving nothing in return. He watched the opening exchange with the interest of a general observing children at chess, lips pursed thoughtfully. Then he took a step to the left and just freaking vanished. I don't mean that he went behind a veil or teleported or opened a portal to the Never Never. I can do those things if I have to. This guy took a step and just up and went away, as if stepping behind a telephone pole and never appearing on the other side. Gone. Just gone. Except that in this case, gone turned out to be 6 inches behind me. My ears suddenly twinged hard, like when the pressure shifts in an airplane, and the empty space behind me wasn't empty anymore. I whirled, drawing my revolver, raising it. Too late. Dracul caught the weapon's barrel in the pale fingers of one hand and simply crushed it shut. His other arm swept out and clubbed Ramirez into a tombstone to the ground as if Dracul's flesh had been made from cold, heavy marble. Dracul whirled toward Wild Bill, who flung himself into an evasive dive without ever looking back from his gun. It wouldn't have been fast enough to save him, except that Chandler sent a quick trio of stones zipping into Dracul's kidneys. Wham! Pow! Crunch! With each stone exploding into gravel from the force of its impact. Dracul turned to Chandler, muttered a word, and flicked an annoyed wrist. The air behind the young warden split with a howl of frozen wind, and a circle of pitch-black absence of light, maybe 4 feet across, appeared behind him. A stone seemed to turn beneath his foot. Chandler's balance wavered, and he stumbled a step back into the circle. The air somehow unscreamed, and the void black circle vanished. Chandler went with it. Dracul's black hole eyes swept back to me, and suddenly I was being crushed to the ground by the weight of the universe itself. The very thought that I could have done something against a power like that was laughable, but I'd felt this kind of raw, universe-bending will before, in Chichen Itza. Dracul, whatever he was, had considerably more personal power than the Lords of Outer Night had ever managed to show me. But I had hoisted those Red Court losers on their own petard when everything was said and done. I would be damned if I rolled over for Dracula's less famous dad. I ground my teeth and fought back against the power crushing me, not with my muscles, but with my mind. I pictured Dracul's will as a great dark hand pressing me down, and mine as my own hand rising to force it away. I poured my will into the image, a couple of decades of discipline, experience, and focus, investing it with power, with reality, with life. Gasping 1 inch at a time, I lifted my hand until my right palm faced Dracul and steadied. I couldn't stand, but I got an elbow underneath me and snarled silent defiance up at him, my right hand raised against his power. An expression touched Dracul's face for the first time, a small smile that showed cruelly curved, sharpened canine teeth.
Ah, he said, raising the knife he'd been planning to use for a blood sacrifice. If only my heir had been possessed of such determination.
It took a lot of concentration to free up enough mental cycles to make word sounds with my mouth, but I wasn't going to sit there and take it quietly.
Guess you're Ethneu's bitch now, I gasped.
The smile again.
It cost little enough to support her. Minor squabbles like this are a good place to take stock of the field.
Field?
Oh, wizard, Dracul chided me. Their immaculate beardlessness have you in the dark even now? As one starborn to another, I must say, it seems unseemly in the extreme.
I stared at him hard.
What does it mean?
Dracul's smile widened into something genuinely merry, except for those empty eyes. Any expression that had those eyes in it could be nothing but a mask.
You'll never value information that comes to you easily. Thanks, Dad.
Something ugly flickered in that smile for a few beats. Then Dracul shook his head.
I would tell you to ask of your own white council what they aren't telling you, what they bred you for, and what they expect you to do, he considered. Well, except that it seems unlikely you'll have the chance on this side of the veil, I'm afraid.
Chump like you, I gasped. Tonight, you're the warm-up act. Dracul regarded me for a second. Then he made an exasperated little sound and put one hand on his hip.
I'll be open with you, Starborn. At this point of conversations like this one, I often offer the dark gift of immortality to someone in your position. It's occasionally a way to obtain a useful tool. But mostly, I just want to see how they react. One sees people for who they truly are when they face death. But honestly, 5 minutes of you in my life has been quite enough. You've no gravitas, no decorum, no style at all.
He knelt over me and lifted the knife toward my throat.
But I suppose your blood will call to the dead as well as anyone's.
Knock, knock, I said. Dracul frowned down at me and arched an eyebrow.
Oh, come on, I said. Here I am facing death and telling you a knock-knock joke. Why would I do such a thing?
I gave him the best grin I could while clenching my teeth.
Eternity is a long time to wonder about a punchline. Knock-knock.
Oh, said Dracul in his mellifluous accent, his eyes narrowed.
He's there. 1,000-pound gorilla,
I rasped.
1,000-pound gorilla who? Asked Dracul.
And River Shoulders roared and hit him with a 12-foot-long concrete obelisk. 1 second, Dracul loomed over me. The next, there was an enormous sound and an explosion of shattering concrete that left half a dozen little cuts on my face, and Dracul was nowhere to be seen. The weight vanished from me so abruptly that for a second I thought I was levitating off the ground. I was suddenly dizzy and my vision narrowed to a tunnel.
"Now that," I gasped, "is comedy."
River's shoulders roared and bounded after Dracul, jumping with all four limbs. Dracul, for his part, tumbled calmly, and if his shoes had cost more than some vehicles I had driven, they held up well enough as he dug them into the grass to arrest his momentum and bring himself to a controlled halt among the tumbling fragments of concrete. He was wearing, I kid you not, a tuxedo under the long black cloak. And he looked annoyed. River's shoulders lowered his shoulder to slam into Dracul, but the big guy might as well have been trying to ram water. Dracul took a step and vanished, out from in front of the charging Sasquatch and to one side, where he crouched and swept his arm out at shin height to the Sasquatch, catching River's shoulder's enormous leg in the crook of his elbow and arresting its momentum as Dracul rose to his feet. The Sasquatch went forward in a sprawl, which he could not turn into a controlled roll, before crashing through two enormous side-by-side tombstones. River's shoulders began to rise, but then sank back to the earth with a groan. Hell's bells. Dracul turned toward River's shoulders with his knife, and I saw what was coming in my head as clearly and sharply as if I was remembering it. The forest people aren't exactly wizards. They just sort of live their lives so steeped in the world of magic that they just do it the way a fish swims or a bird flies. Their aura of life energy is especially dense and potent, constantly absorbing power from the natural world around them, which would make the big guy a great big tank of nitrous for Dracul's necromantic summoning. If the master of the Black Court could spill River's blood to fuel the spell. I grabbed my staff and brought it to bear, feeling the seething energy stored within its runes and sigils vibrate to life. The staff began to glow with green gold light, even as I reached out to a portion of the energy stored within it, stirring it, urging it to glow even more brightly. I wanted him to see this one coming.
"Hey!" I shouted. "You! Ugly!"
Yeah, not my best insult work, but you know, it's the thought that counts. Dracul turned to look at me and froze for a second as if in surprise, presenting a fleeting instant of vulnerability.
"Forzari!"
I shouted. As I began the word, Dracul took a step to one side and vanished. I whipped my still glowing staff toward River's shoulders and this time unleashed my will along with the word,
"Forzari!"
A glowing column of green gold light, flickering and ephemeral as the aurora borealis, lashed across the ground between me and River's shoulders and caught Dracul right in the breadbasket as he reappeared standing over River's shoulders' head with his knife. The column of power hit Dracul with the energy of a speeding train engine. It blew back his hair and his clothing, ripping the latter to tatters, and sent him hurling into the side of a marble mausoleum with such force that it sent a spider web of cracks through the stone. Then there was the cry of an eagle from somewhere up above us, defiant and mocking, and the sweltering summer air was split by a sound so loud and a light so bright that it robbed me of my breath. The image of a bolt of blue-white lightning coming down in a nearly vertical column was burned into the backs of my eyelids. It hit Dracul like a giant's sledgehammer, pounding him to the ground. And a second later, a bear, a goddamn Kodiak grizzly, just plummeted out of the sky, landed on Dracul, and started slamming sledgehammer paws down onto the pale being's skull. Elders of the White Council don't screw around either, and Listens to Wind knew how to make an entrance. I staggered, catching my balance on my staff. The lightning had left my eyes dazzled. The thunder had left my ears ringing. I couldn't hear, couldn't see any of my companions except for River's shoulders. I hurried to his side, and even as I did, River shook his head groggily and began to push himself up.
"That's cheating," the Sasquatch rumbled, and his voice was angry, terrifying.
River came to his feet in a single, fluid motion, gathering with him a small tidal wave of magical energy that suddenly crackled and sparked with static in the air around him. He screamed and slammed both fists down onto the earth, sending out a wave of raw power that I couldn't have matched at my best. Just as the Kodiak bear let out a roar of pain and went flying away into one side. Dracul came to his feet, a marble statue clad in scorched shreds of black and white. He whirled toward River's shoulders, smiled, took a step to one side, and collided with empty air with an audible sound of impact. Dracul blinked, this time clearly surprised, and recoiled in the other direction, only to rebound again as if from the surface of a funhouse mirror maze. He turned toward the Sasquatch, dark eyes narrowing.
"Okay, Mr. Dancy Pants," growled River Shoulders. "Now, let's see how tough you are."
Dracul's black eyes glittered with an almost sexual intensity, and his sudden, wide smile was utterly unnerving.
"I like this game much better," he said in something like a purr,
and he laughed, taking slow steps back. As he did, without a whisper of power evident in the air, the graveyard began to fill with fog, as swiftly and rapidly as if he'd pulled down a cloud on top of us. The laughter lingered behind him like the Cheshire Cat's smile. The Kodiak rolled to its feet and padded over to us. Somewhere along the way, in the sudden fog, listens to wind took its place. The old man padded to us and put his back to ours, his eyes and senses clearly focused outward, over the rims of his spectacles. Listens to Wind never looked excited, but tonight his dark eyes glittered brightly. "Mr. Dancy Pants?" I asked River Shoulders. The Sasquatch shrugged.
"Better than, hey, you ugly."
Listens to Wind made a soft hissing sound that commanded silence. River Shoulders listened to him, so it seemed like maybe it would be wise for me to do it, too. So I heard the last few deep thuds of heavy paws striking the ground, and a great black nightmare wolf, a creature out of prehistoric nightmares, taller than me at the shoulders and weighing more than many cars, plunged into our group. I dove out of the great wolf's path and only got my ankles clipped as I went. It spun me 180 degrees before I hit the ground, still spinning. I looked back over my shoulder to see the form of the vast wolf over Bear River's shoulders and ride him to the ground. The Sasquatch roared and slammed his fists into the Dracul wolf, but the beast shrugged the blows off, fangs seeking River's throat. I twisted and lifted my staff, preparing a blast of force that would push the wolf off River's shoulders. And an arm, like a bar of cold iron, slipped around my throat, as swift and lithe as a young serpent. My air was cut off immediately. I couldn't make a sound. I struggled, but felt like a child trying to fight an adult. Within seconds, I was off balance and being dragged silently away among the tombstones. I saw Listens to Wind turn into a friggin' bison and charge the great wolf's flank before the fog swallowed them all. And I had time to realize that neither of them had seen me being taken. And in all the fog, neither had anyone else. I was alone.
"Dresden,"
Mavra hissed. Her voice sounded almost as pleasant as beetles devouring desiccated flesh.
"I have so been looking forward to seeing you again."
Chapter 13. Thanks to the winter mantle, I am stronger than most, by which I mean most professional wrestlers. Strong as I am, though, my strength still falls within the normal parameters of humanity. I might be pretty far along that bell curve, but I'm still on the same graph. Black Court vampire strength is on the same graph as military vehicles and construction equipment. Mavra dragged me as effortlessly as if I'd been leased to a bulldozer, and the arm around my neck might as well have been made of carbon steel.
I thrashed and kicked, and not only was it futile, she didn't even take notice of it.
I was able to gasp in a few precious wisps of air during the struggles, but probably not enough to make up for the loss of the struggle itself. I wanted to panic, but panic wouldn't help me survive. So I fastened my grip on that implacable arm and held on tight, trying to take the pressure off my neck and otherwise cease doing anything but fighting for air. The struggle behind me was a nearly silent one, broken only by the sounds of impacts, weight scrambling on the grass, and harsh exhalations. Mavra dragged me silently through the graveyard in the fog until we found other dark, silent forms beneath the branches of a spreading tree. On the ground at their feet were more figures: Wild Bill, Yoshimo, Ramirez. Wild Bill and Yoshimo were a mass of blood that looked wet and black in the dim light. Ramirez was still alive. He was on his knees, and one of the Black Court elders, the one with the tentacle spell, held Carlos's wrists pinned behind his back.
"Where's the drum?"
demanded Tentacles Guy as Mavra approached.
"Welcome, Mavra,"
Mavra said in a light, mocking rasp.
"You were right about how they would respond to the threat, Mavra. The Master is wise to trust you, Mavra."
Yoshimo had died with her eyes partly open. They stared. She didn't look like a young woman anymore. She looked like a broken, discarded machine. Tentacles Guy bared bloody teeth and hissed,
"We must finish preparing these and go to the Master's aid."
Mavra hissed a little laugh.
"If you wish to disturb his recreation, by all means."
One of the two twin corpse vampires was on the ground. It looked like a chunk of mass that might have weighed 30 pounds in a living being was just missing from one of the twins' abdomens. Ramirez's blasts, probably. Its mouth was covered in fresh blood, and there were slurping, sucking sounds coming from the open wound as blood and matter shifted and slowly renewed the missing mass. It was staring steadily, hungrily, at Ramirez. The other twin pointed at me.
"Give it to my sister. She must restore herself."
"His blood is not for the likes of you or me,"
Mavra replied calmly.
"Starborn are for the Master."
Both twins hissed at Mavra, who appeared to take no notice of them. Wild Bill had gone down fighting. His rifle and sidearm were both gone. So was his trademark knife. The skin was gone from his knuckles, and there was something black and sludgy on his open mouth. He'd gone down swinging, with bits of his enemy literally between his teeth.
"The drum," Tentacles Guy insisted.
"This was never about raising an army, fool,"
Mavra hissed.
"It was about acquiring new blood for the Stars and Stones. Let Korb and Ethnew thrash about and draw the ire of the mortals upon themselves. We will be well positioned to rule the rebel." She pointed a finger at Ramirez. "Give her that one to eat."
Tentacles Guy stared at Mavra harshly. Then he dragged Ramirez over to the wounded twin. Ramirez fought against Tentacles Guy, with just as much to show for it as I had with Mavra. The other twin stretched out Ramirez's arm and raked rotten nails across his wrists, tearing open flesh and veins with all the precision and subtlety of an ox-driven plow. Ramirez screamed. The downed twin fastened her rotting lips over the wound in his arm. My friends were dead and dying, and these things wanted to make of their remains a home for more monsters. Sickness and rage filled me. Power rushed in with them. Mavra's grip on my neck tightened like something driven by hydraulics, and suddenly there was nothing but blind, furious sensation filtered through the winter mantle in a tsunami of confusing sensory input that became its own agonizing analog of prosaic pain.
"The Master won't mind drinking you at room temperature, Dresden," she chided me.
The universe blurred,
and suddenly the floor rose to give me a full body hug. It blew the wind out of me in an exhalation not even Mavra's strength could shut off entirely and left me lying, stunned.
Pendejos, Ramirez snarled. I could feel the air tighten as he drew in power.
The other twin's hands shot out as he did, dragging his face to hers. Her milky white eyes widened as she locked gazes with Ramirez. My friend let out a furious, despairing scream as her psychic assault began.
Yeah.
The Black Court had a method for dealing with the potential devastation of a wizard's death curse. Tough to put together a spell when someone is trying to climb into your brain and redecorate. The vampires watched the dying man intently, slipping into a corpse-like, absolute stillness as they did.
Carlos tried to scream again. It came out weaker. There was nothing I could do.
And then something wispy and violet poked out from behind a tombstone 20 feet away. Someone had seen me. The Major General was still on the job. Toot Toot scanned the scene quickly, flashed me a manic grin and a wink, and slid back behind the tombstone. When he emerged a moment later, he held a short sword the size of a small hunting knife in one hand. And in the other, gripped like a severed head, was an open packet of chopped garlic from Pizza Express. Toot crouched, still grinning, and a nimbus of blue and violet energy surrounded him. And then he shot like an arrow from a bow at Mavra's back. There was a streak of light as Toot flew at her, slashing down with his knife at the dead tough flesh of her back, the scalpel sharp blade opening a deep cut, into which my little ally plunged his packet of garlic. Black Court vampires are very, very tough customers, but they pay for it in some really inconvenient vulnerabilities. You can read about them in Stoker's book. It's basically a field guide on how to kill Black Court vampires. Turns out there's a pretty good reason vampires are repelled by garlic. Mavra's dead flesh burst into silver white flame. I mean, it was awkward to see from my angle, but a freaking jet of argent fire shot out of the wound, and the sound of her shriek of agony became the entire world for a few seconds. I guess being set on fire is kind of distracting. I fought the headlock with all of my strength and exploded out of it, drawing in a deep gasp of sweet, sweet air. Which, instead of turning into the words of an immediate spell, got locked into the helpless autonomic cycle of an oncoming sneeze. Of all the times, stupid conjuritis. Now? Mavra thrashed out with one arm, hit me in the back, and clubbed me 10 feet. Only the protective spells on my duster kept me from getting broken bones. I got my arms between my skull and the oncoming tombstone, or I would have checked out right then and there, bounced, and hit the ground. I focused, bringing power and image to my thoughts, rapidly gathering energy to put behind the oncoming sneeze. The unwounded twin whirled her head toward me and hissed. My chest convulsed into a sneeze that might have torn some muscles somewhere. I sent power and the image out along with it. And an anvil, black and funny-shaped and half as long as a freaking car, plunged out of the night air and right into the back half of Tentacles Guy's noggin. The plummeting anvil had to have weighed at least a ton, and while you could wail on a Black Court vampire with a baseball bat all day and inflict nothing more than annoyance, that much weight, moving at that rate of speed, was an entirely different ball game. Imagine holding a fully hung suit and dropping it to the floor. Now, add a spray pattern of ink-black Icarus splatter, plus a big freaking anvil. Get the picture? Mavra vanished, screaming into the night, the fog lit weirdly by argent fire in her wake. The healthy twins stared in shock at the anvil, which suddenly collapsed into gelatinous ectoplasm, mixing with whatever was left of Tentacles Guy, who was still, somehow, thrashing. It looked kind of like the inside of a blender.
I swiped a shaking arm over my running nose and wheezed drunkenly.
I told you, you Black Court bastards! Next time, anvils!
Ramirez, his arms freed, whipped toward the creature mindlessly feeding upon his wounded arm, snarled a word, flicked his other wrist, and suddenly her head just turned into a slurry of water and powder. The remainder of the body started thrashing around silently, spewing ichor everywhere. Carlos gasped as bones in his forearm snapped in the grip of superhumanly powerful hands. The other twin seized a tombstone, ripped it out of the ground as if it had been a damned dandelion, and flung it at my head. There was just time to get my shield up, and the tombstone exploded into gravel against it. By the time I lowered my hand and looked around again, shield bracelet still dribbling green-gold sparks, the twin was gone. So were the bodies of Yoshimo and Wild Bill. I stumbled over to Ramirez's side. We wrestled the stupidly powerful strength still left in the dead vampire's hands until I finally had to pit what felt like the strength of my whole body against the vampire's fingers, one at a time. It wasn't easy on Ramirez, who must have been suffering agonies, but we got it done. I pulled him back as he cradled his shattered arm, and we watched the corpse thrash itself across the ground. They took them, Ramirez muttered. They're going to... Nothing we can do for them this second, I said. I got into the first aid pack on his belt. In the dark, it was a sloppy mess, but I got a pressure bandage over his wrist and got it tightly covered. It had to have hurt like hell on the broken arm, but we had to stop the bleeding. Ramirez clenched his jaw and hissed, but gave no other sign of discomfort. I finished and rose. Come on, we need to back up river and listen to wind. He looked up at me, his face pale, his eyes too shiny and hard, but he grimaced and nodded and lifted his good hand. I hauled him up, and the two of us had just turned toward where I'd last seen the senior councilman in River's shoulders when the same pair walked out of the fog. River's chest was rising and falling harshly. He sounded like a racehorse and moved as if his entire body was one enormous bruise. He was carrying an unconscious teenage girl in the crook of one arm like an infant. The victim Dracul and company had been preparing to sacrifice. Listens to Wind looked unutterably weary but unhurt. What happened? I asked.
He left before we could get hurt too bad,
River's shoulder said, his voice pained. Listens to Wind grimaced and reached way, way up to thump a hand against River's shoulder's shoulder.
Creature like that, you don't beat it. You win by surviving. We won.
Not all of us, Ramirez said in a harsh voice.
Dracul sent Chandler through some kind of gate, I said. It didn't look like the usual passage to Never Never. It was all neat and symmetrical.
Which meant that Chandler could have wound up anywhere. Or worse, nowhere.
I leaned into the winter. My voice sounded steady and rational. No idea of his status. Myers and Yoshimo were dead, probably turned. The pain was still there. Shock in the winter mantle might have been numbing it. I didn't have a whole ton of friends. Losing three of them at once was going to hurt like hell later. Even thinking about that made my guts quiver and my heart burn with rage. Listens to Wind seemed to shrink a little and closed his eyes.
I think this wasn't an alliance for Dracul. Merely a profitable ploy. If we did not arrive in sufficient strength to stop the sacrifice, the enemy has an army at our backs, the city is overrun, and I dare say Dracul would have his choice of potential recruits in the chaos. If we did send those of sufficient power to stop him, Dracul need not go hunting for potent new servants. They have voluntarily identified themselves. He left because he'd gotten what he'd come for, I said. Listens to Wind opened his eyes and nodded. And because he doesn't care about what's happening here today.
What's happening here today is going to affect everyone, I said. Not him, the old wizard said, his voice certain. He's got a different set of priorities. Because he's starborn, I guessed. Listens to Wind looked at me sharply. Hey, I said brightly, what are the stars and stones? The old man's eyes narrowed. He traded a long look with River's shoulders. We should get back to the others, Listens to Wind said, and turned to start walking back the way we'd come. I took a long step and got in his way. I asked you a question, Senior Councilman, I said quietly but firmly. River's shoulders shook his head tiredly. Hoss, Dresden, we got a lot on our plates right now. There's plenty that you don't know yet, and maybe this story isn't mine to tell. Seriously? I asked. That's your excuse? You don't want to spoiler me? He regarded me levelly. I've said what I'm going to, Hoss Dresden. It ain't time yet. I shook my head impatiently. I'm getting some damned answers. My whole life, since my parents died, my life has been one person after another trying to get something out of me, wanting me to make deals, give them my loyalty. And there's this whole starborn thing. My voice dropped. My whole life, I've had to figure it out on my own. I'm getting a damned answer. I've put myself at risk over and over for the council. I've lost friends. I swallowed. I've paid for it. You owe me. The old man looked away and wouldn't meet my eyes. We owe you, he confirmed. But it ain't about debt. There's some secrets that do worse than get you killed. A whole hell of a lot worse, he eyed me. You need to trust us. I barked out a laugh. It sounded weird in the graveyard. Pull the other one. The old man sighed. Then he said, make you a deal. What? You get through tonight, Listens to Wind said. You give me a little time. I'll be your advocate. I'll speak on your behalf to the others.
Or you could just tell me yourself.
I'm a wizard, Hoss, which means I'm arrogant. He smiled a little. But not that arrogant. That's how big this is, boy. I, a senior wizard of the White Council, don't think I'm smart enough to make this call alone. I blinked. That was not a sentiment I'd ever thought I might hear from a senior councilman. Oh, I said. Wow. Best I can do, he said. I'll wait a month, he snorted through his nose. The people I need to talk to, make it a year. Fuck that, I said. Oh, he asked. Tell me, what's your next best offer? The old man lifted his eyebrows and waited, visibly and politely. Fine, I said sourly. A year. He nodded. Done. The would-be sacrificial girl on River's shoulder stirred, looked around at the Sasquatch, opened her mouth to scream in horror, and almost immediately fainted again. River's shoulders looked mournful.
I lost my glasses in the fighting.
Not your fault, big guy, I said. Some people just don't know good company when they see it. We'd better drop her off with the next group of cops we pass. Agreed, Listens to Wind said. You're just going to keep going, Ramirez said. His voice shook with intensity. Those things took our people. They're profaning them. Cold rage suffused me and I whirled on Carlos. And they're going to get theirs, but not now. There are 8 million people who have no one else to defend them, just us. So we're going to take care of business. And once we're done here, we're going to settle up with Dracul and his peeps. Right now, there are more important things to handle. But they're on our list, and we will check them off. Bank on it. Ramirez stared hard at me for a second. Then he raised his fist. I answered. We bumped knuckles.
hard enough to draw blood. Chapter 14. If there is anything good about a fight, it's that they don't tend to last very long. Especially not fights between a terror as absolute as vampires of the Black Court and people slinging around power of creation itself. If we hurried, we might catch up with the rest of the group before they got to the front. It's easier to move faster with fewer people. We left the cemetery behind and kept heading east toward the shores of Lake Michigan. There were more people fleeing now, screams and shouts and hushed, forced whispers. River's shoulders strode openly down the street, carrying the unconscious young woman in one arm and Ramirez in the other. I jogged along and listened to wind, shook himself into the shape of a rangy old hound and loped easily along beside me. At the junction of Montrose and Hazel, there was a large group of police officers waving people past them and instructing them to head west at their best speed. There was a little pub there that had a courtyard that had only one entrance where customers could park their cars. Several cars had been pushed across that entrance as an improvised barricade, and police officers with assault rifles stood at the barricade, looking nervously out into the darkness. Behind them was a triage area where several EMTs were working frantically in battlefield conditions to save lives. There were maybe a dozen people back there. Several looked like refugees who had fallen or been hit by some kind of debris. But three of them were Einherjaren. Trust me, they stand out like a biker at the Vatican, and they were clearly the worst off. It was well lit enough by a large fire in a steel barrel and dozens of flares that you could see the walls around the courtyard all the way up to the roof. Three officers had positioned themselves to watch the roof at the head of each wall. There were bloodstains up there. Something had evidently tried to come over it and been fought back. The light was a problem, really, in this situation. Standing in it meant that you had to stay in it or else work blind in the dark while your eyes slowly adjusted. Of course, without the light, the EMTs couldn't do their work. It's an imperfect world. The gunfire was closer and heavier now. I could make out individual shots and hear screams. Screams on a battlefield aren't like the ones you hear on TV. They're high-pitched, falsetto shrieks and choked, gasping exhalations. Not all of them could have been human, but from where I was standing, they all sounded pretty much the same. I stopped before we walked into the radius of the light around the defensive position and said, "River, maybe instead of walking up to all the nice frightened officers holding assault rifles, you should let me take the girl over there."
"Huh," the Sasquatch said. "Well, I did lose my glasses. Might be simpler."
I took the girl from him, carrying her in both arms. The old hound paced along lightly at my side, moving with the spring of a much younger creature. I walked forward into the light, holding the girl, and said,
"Hey, CPD, I need to get this girl some help."
Rifles swung to cover me, and I prayed that the officers had decent trigger discipline. I'd have hated to get accidentally shot.
"Don't move,"
shouted several cops at the barricades. I didn't.
"Keep moving west, sir,"
shouted several others at the same time.
"Which is it, guys?"
I called back to them.
"I can't not move and go west."
There was a commotion at the barricade. One of the officers stepped back, and a dark, scowling face under a tight cut of silver hair peered out at me.
"Dresden," he called. "That you?"
"Rollins," I said. The old detective had spent a lot of time in special investigations. We'd worked together before. He was a burly man with a particularly expressive face, and his knuckles were lumpy with ancient scars. He carried a shotgun like it was an additional limb, and I trusted him.
"What the hell, man?" I called. "I thought you retired."
He grimaced and nodded toward the sound of gunfire.
"2 more weeks."
I nodded toward the girl. "I need to drop her off with someone. I got stuff to do. Can I come in?" Depends, man. What was the name you knew me by the first time we met? An authority figure, I replied.
Good enough for me,
he said, and nodded to the officers on the barricade. Let him in. I carried the girl across the street and through a narrow gap in the cars that I had to turn sideways to navigate. Rollins met me inside and led me back to the triage area. It took me a second to realize that practically every cop there was staring at me. I overheard them speaking to one another. They must have fired enough rounds to make their ears ring because their mutters were coming out at a conversational volume.
Is that him? Someone asked. The wizard, Dresden, yeah. Is he for real? Sure as hell hope so. Did you see those things?
Bullshit, he's just a con man.
Eyes out,
Rollins snapped to all of them.
You think this is a goddamn circus?
That did it. And they piped down and went back to watching the darkness. Rollins led me to an improvised bed made out of a folding table laid flat on the ground with a layer of soft packing foam on top. I laid the girl down on it, and an EMT, his skin nearly as dark as Rollins, bent over to examine her. Lamar, I said, long time no see.
That's because I don't want nothing to do with you and your weird shit, Dresden,
Lamar said. Lamar is one of the more sensible people I've ever met.
Then what are you doing here? I asked.
Lamar shrugged.
What'd I do?
He peeled back an eyelid on the girl, checked her pulse with a stethoscope, and rummaged in a medical kit beside him.
It's your fault?
Not this time, I said. Honest. He drawled, infusing both syllables with skepticism. It's not always my fault, I said.
Sure, he said, with even denser skepticism.
He took out a small paper tube from the kit. He snapped it in half and waved the broken ends under the young woman's nose. She shuddered and abruptly lurched, her eyes flying wide open. She started screaming.
Back off, both of you, Lamar said. Let me work.
I traded a glance with Rollins and we backed off. He beckoned and walked over to an empty corner of the courtyard. I followed.
The hell is happening? Rollins asked me, intently under his breath once we were out of earshot. Monsters on the walls with guns. Guys with spears that shoot explosions. Goddamn mercenaries with military-grade gear. What the hell is going on?
I took a breath and tried to think how best to condense it.
Bad guys from my side of the street have decided to destroy Chicago. And every monster and weirdo in Chicago has turned out to fight them.
Rollins stared at me for a moment before he said,
Shit.
Rollins was even better at condensing than me. I glanced over at Lamar, who had gotten the girl to sit up. She was weeping and shuddering uncontrollably, and he was trying to get her to drink some water.
I gotta go, man, I said. Every minute I'm here is costing lives.
Where's Carrie?
Rollins had been friends with Murphy's dad back in the day. He was the only person I knew who dared call her by a diminutive nickname.
As safe as I can make her.
He pursed his lips.
Oh, bet she loved that.
He leaned over to ruffle the hound's ears affectionately and glanced down at my hip as he did.
That coach gun legal?
No. He nodded. Didn't think so. You got enough ammo.
Tonight there's no such thing as enough ammo. Rollins snorted.
Ain't that the truth?
He leaned a little closer and said very quietly,
Rudolph and his partner were in the middle of putting out an APB on you when the grid blew out. Once it's up again, I figure they're gonna have the entire CPD looking for you.
Oh, I sighed. Joy. I eyed him. Why tell me?
Carrie likes you, and Rudolph is a prick.
Tough to argue with that. His teeth flashed very white when he smiled.
Good hunting, Dresden.
I clasped his shoulder wordlessly for a second, then spun and headed back out of the courtyard to rejoin River and Ramirez.
2 weeks, Rollins muttered as I left. Gonna die of cliche poisoning.
I walked back into the darkness and was promptly blinded to anything in it. I stumbled and faltered, but the hound stayed at my side, his shoulder against my leg, guiding me. I kept walking in the direction I knew they were and tried not to gibber as I walked sightlessly forward. "I'm just saying," River Shoulder's rumbling voice said. "You just draw two little lines from the corner of your mouth, and then we have a public relations act. Humans love ventriloquists." Ramirez replied in an exhausted, bemused voice, "It might take more than that to establish relations between the forest people and humanity at large." "Got to start somewhere," River's Shoulders said. "And the first place you went was a ventriloquist act?" Ramirez asked. "Maybe we should live through the night first, then think it through for a while." River's Shoulders rumbled. "Probably smart." My eyes adjusted enough to make out dim shapes, and I said, "All right, folks, let's get a move on." The hound ran forward and leapt into the air, and a hawk soared away. Man, I need to learn how to do stuff like that one of these days. "All right," I said. "We..." River Shoulder scooped me up in his other arm and bounded forward. Now, I don't know if you've ever been scooped up by a Sasquatch or not, but it isn't the sort of thing you forget. I'm a pretty big guy. River lifted me as if I were a toddler, and when he ran, it wasn't running, really, in a typical sense. It was more like a series of alternating single-leg broad jumps, covering 30 feet at a stride. River went from 0 to maybe 50 miles an hour in 3 steps, and damn near gave me whiplash doing it. The gunfire swelled rapidly as we reached Montrose and Clarendon. On the left side of Montrose was a large Art Deco office building, shining glass and steel. The first 2 levels of the structure were an open-sided parking garage. The Ein Hajaran had taken it, and gunfire roared out of the garage on both levels, flashes of light and bursts of thunder, all directed toward Clarendon Park. On the right side of the street was another office building, nearly the size of its opposite, and I could see teams on the roof firing big, big single rounds down toward the park with those huge sniper rifles Barrett makes. Shadow and motion filled the park. Huntsmen and octocons rushed forward in swift dashes, faster than any human could have done it. The city's defenders concentrated their fire on the huntsmen, and with good reason. There were several large holes blown in the low walls of the parking garage, and ugly scorched remains were visible. Assault rifles did an excellent job on the first several huntsmen of any given pack, but by the time the last few of them had gone all Hulk, it was up to the Barretts. The octocons weren't as much of a threat until they got closer. The ape squid things had the upper body of a gorilla mounted on the lower chassis of an octopus, hence Octocong. Good thing they hadn't used chimps, or I'd have to call them octopongs, and that just sounds silly. The octocongs could slither along the ground at great speed, and when they climbed, tentacles flailing, they didn't really slow down. Each bore a large, crude-looking weapon that made me think of those old blunderbusses, but they were fed by a magazine of some kind. The octocongs weren't exactly snipers. They didn't really aim. They just pointed the weapons in a general direction and pulled the trigger.